Senegal is not a very well-known country, but Mauritania is even less well-known. But it's an enormous country. It doesn't show up here, but it goes way up here into the Sahara. I guess I can show you on the globe. This whole yellow thing is Mauritania. And all those countries are enormous in size because they're mostly desert. And Mauritania is one of those countries in the world that people say are in danger of sort of being blown away by the desert. It really does not have a lot left to it. It was a country that many of us simply never thought about. Even though I was living practically on the border in this town called Njoum, Senegal. So here's the map of Senegal. You remember that there's this tiny country called Gambia cut out of Senegal. This purple is the Senegal River. There wasn't a blue here. And geography, it may seem like really obscure geography. I mean, it's really not important as the world goes. But to understand this situation, which I think is a very dramatic and interesting situation because it relates in a very small way to many other refugee situations that are going on that affect many more people. So that's what I want to explain to you. The Senegal River is the breadbasket of this area of the world. I mean, it's not a very large area. It regularly floods, and as the flood recedes, much as you may have heard the Nile used to do, and that's how people grew so many crops in ancient Egypt, as the flood recedes, people planted sorghum and were able to get a very good crop. In recent years, of course, irrigation has been the focus, enabling us to grow even more. Mauritania, the country to the north, like I said, is mostly desert. But it's inhabited desert. We sometimes forget that as we see just the sand dunes with absolutely nobody there. But there are groups of people who have adapted to that very harsh climate and earth conditions and managed to live. And for the most part, they're nomads. And the people of Mauritania that lived in all this area are one ethnic group, I guess we can call it, the Moors. And they're sometimes called Arab Berbers. They're a mixture of Arab and Berber people. They speak a dialect of Arab. There are whites and there are blacks that they took as slaves. So the black Moors were taken from any of the black countries. I mean, all the countries to the south were populated by blacks. They came down on slave raids from, I don't know when, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, took blacks and brought them back up into Mauritania. Now, much as perhaps with American blacks, they've lost their original language. So they consider themselves ethnically to be Moor, the blacks. Slavery was outlawed in Mauritania for the last time in 1980. So this is not ancient history we're talking about when we say former slaves. They're officially all free now. But even in the area where I was working, former slaves are still called slaves. And in the minds of these white Moors, I think for most of them, they have not left that old thought about them being slaves, even if they're no longer officially slaves. Many of them are attached to their former owners and serve them in order to get money. There can still be that work relationship or simply a relationship of knowing that that person's family is my family's slave. They don't consider them to be as human beings with as much dignity as themselves. So there's tensions there. But we need to remember that they all consider themselves Moors. And when this very strange conflict came up, they were together, the white Moors and the black Moors. So it wasn't as racial as we thought. The other main ethnic group in Mauritania are the black Halkulars. Now that's the real name. There are other names that people have used, but this is the real name. I know it's long. It means people who speak Pular, and that's their name for themselves. So that's the name that ethnologists use. And black Halkulars have traditionally had this area. This was their kingdom, and one of the main old empires of West Africa was called Tekrur, and it was around the 12th century that this was a pretty important empire. We don't know a lot about it because they didn't write things down, but we have a little bit of archaeological evidence and a few things that Arabs who went there wrote about. So we know that it was a very important kingdom, and that was of the Halkular people. They lived, of course, on both sides of the river. As a river is a link, not a divider. They never thought of it that way. But as you know, colonialism, in its wisdom, the Europeans split up Africa. Starting with the conference in Berlin in the end of the 19th century, the different European powers who had started to conquer these African areas split them into what would be most convenient for them. Now, France got the bulk of West Africa. And if you studied geography before 1960, you would have probably learned about French West Africa and then French Equatorial Africa. Those were the two main countries. And Britain from the beginning called them Gambia, Nigeria, Ghana, etc. But within French West Africa was a number of provinces, and that's how the countries were split up at independence. And so Mauritania was a province, Senegal was a province, and Senegal just happened to be, well, Dakar happened to be the capital of all of French West Africa, and that's why Senegal has so many advantages. Mauritania has no advantages at all, but they were part of French West Africa, and at independence time, actually, let me step back. Mauritania was not a province of French West Africa. It was created at independence time because France especially wanted a buffer between the Arabs of the north. This is Western Sahara, and you've probably read about some of the conflicts that are there. I mean, again, it's so far away, but with the Polisario, they've been fighting for independence for Western Sahara from Morocco for 20, 30 years. It's one of those long, long conflicts in the desert where, you know, thousands of lives and millions of dollars are being totally wasted, and no one knows what will come out as the outcome. But Morocco feels that all this is their territory. Western Sahara was colonized by Spain. So Mauritania was created to be a buffer between the Arabs and the blacks. And I guess for a time it seemed to work fairly well. You may be reading more and more lately about conflicts between Arabs and blacks in Africa. Newsweek did a full page spread a few months ago about it. Similar problems exist in Sudan, similar problems exist in Chad, and in many of these other countries that are between Arab North Africa and black sub-Saharan Africa. Anyway, Mauritania was created, the capital Nouakchott was created where there was nothing. It was built to have about 50,000 people in it, and there are presently a little over 600,000, it said, living in shacks with no infrastructure at all, meaning no water, no sanitation, anything. Because it was not thought that this was going to be a big city. But the nomads, because of drought, as we know in the 70s and 80s, all left and came into the city. Anyway, the point here being that the river was drawn as a border between Senegal and Mauritania, whereas it had already always been simply a link between the people on the north of the river and the south of the river. So now suddenly these people who are certainly brothers and sisters, or at least cousins, often got married across the river, suddenly they were citizens of two different countries. Well, from the time I got there until April of 1989, it made very little difference as far as I could see. People were still getting married to their relatives that were Mauritanian, and nobody really thought too much about which country they were officially citizens of. As a matter of fact, most of them had identity cards from both countries just in case through, you know, I mean, things are so unofficial there and you get identity cards as you can that it really was not a problem. Smuggling was rampant because Senegal has very strict import laws, and so sugar, wheat, everything was coming down from Mauritania to Senegal, and nobody worried too much about it. It was a border that people sort of ignored. What happened in April of 1989, and this is certainly not an important event in the general history of the world, but it's a very important event for the people that I lived with and want to tell you about. So I hope it doesn't seem too obscure. There were the area down here by Bogate, there were Senegalese that were growing fields in an island in the middle of the river. So nobody knows where that belongs. And Mauritanian white Moor camel owners, their herders, they ride around on camels, came in and let their camels eat up all the field. And so the Senegalese farmers were mad. I mean, it's the old herder-farmer conflict at the same time, too. You know, the cowboys and the farmers should be friends, but they're not. The farmers shot the camels, and so the Mauritanians were mad and came across and shot a number of Senegalese people. and took many more prisoner back into Mauritania. Well, this caused quite an uproar, and the general impression of the Senegalese, where I was in Injoum, was that they didn't respond. The government of Senegal did not respond firmly enough, so they took it upon themselves to attack the Mauritanian citizens that were in their town, because there's so much flow of people that in our town, probably at that time, we probably had 100 Mauritanians. So as getting back at Mauritania for what they did to Senegalese way down here, people in Injoum and all these villages attacked Mauritanians. There was terrible bloodshed on both sides. All the stores owned by Mauritanians were looted, and they ran back basically over the border. And this started happening all through the country. So of course word got back. Of course the same thing happened in Mauritania. Hundreds of thousands of Senegalese are up in Mauritania. And they were getting attacked. So there was a huge international airlift. All the Mauritanians got on airplanes here, or however they could, and they went back to Mauritania. And all the Senegalese came back to Senegal. And they say probably about 300,000 people changed places in about a week. It was really a massive airlift. So it was a terrible situation. Shocked everybody, especially if you know anything about Senegal, which is one of the strongest democracies in Africa. It's been a very peaceful country. Very progressive country, has strong secular democratic values, and nobody thought that it would happen there. So both countries were at fault without any doubt. But then what started to happen was that the Mauritanian government, taking advantage of this upheaval which was happening, started sending not only the Senegalese back to Senegal, but a number of Mauritanians, blacks, who are from this area, also across the border, saying that they were Senegalese because they're from an ethnic group that's primarily in Senegal. But of course, their inherited land, their ancestral land, is on the Mauritanian side. Now the fact is, they don't care whether they're Mauritanian or Senegal, but that's their land, and they're very attached to their land. It brings up a lot of conflicts, a lot of stresses as development goes on and the region changes, which I'm going to talk about later. But how it affected me was I was simply living in my village, working with gardens, trees, very slow work. There were rewards, a lot of frustrations. You never know if you're doing the right thing. You always want to avoid creating dependency and help people to be more independent. But suddenly, right across from Bobe, it wasn't right in Injoum, but it was just across. I just put these cities on because they're major cities, so you can see why so many refugees came down where I was. Because all the blacks, well, not all the blacks in Bobe, but all the blacks in LA had been forced out. And they were sent to Senegal. And that was the work of the Mauritanian government. No one else. And I don't think I'm giving you propaganda here. I think this is generally internationally recognized fact. The Mauritanian government was kicking out their own citizens. And I just want to read a few stories, because it's clearer that way. When I first started talking with the refugees, first started hearing about this, I went up to the village that's just across the river, and there these people were just inundated. This little village of maybe 500 people suddenly had 1,000 refugees living in it that they were trying to take care of. And this is the first week, so nobody knew about it internationally. And the chief of the village was fortunately a very wealthy person. It's sometimes nice that there are people that have a lot of money. They considered these blacks to be their brothers and sisters, and of course they would take care of them. They did everything in their power. So it was by no means an international effort without the Senegalese working. They were the inspiration. They were the ones who gave everything. But of course in a very poor area like that, they're not capable of feeding twice as many people as they are when they're barely managing on their own, and that's the responsibility of the international community. But their response was very moving. The young people of the village were getting together, cooking huge meals, and at first, the chief of the village reported that he was spending of his own money this was when there was only 600 people, about $200 a day to feed all of them. Well, he could manage it because he was wealthy, like most of us could, but most of us would get a little tired too of feeding at the cost of $200, and it got more than that, $300 a day, uninvited guests who suddenly were staying in our villages. So that's why oh, I wrote a report, and it was really amazing how it got circulated in Dakar, and other people started hearing about it at the same time. It got on BBC, and it became, you know, relatively for there a fairly well-known issue. But the very first time that I interviewed some of them, I wrote down some of their stories. So I just want to read a couple of these. This will be really quick. To give you an idea of what these refugees had gone through, I mean, these were people that I was talking to, and I just tried to take notes, because they were really happy to tell their stories, sad as they were, because they wanted the international press to start talking about them, which, you know, as you know, was not highly successful, because I'm sure not one of you has ever read anything about Mauritanian refugees in the American press anyway. I would be very surprised. I next talked to the representative of refugees from Bohadid, a larger town 10 miles from Aleg. So Aleg is a major town. They came from one neighborhood of the Halpular people, the blacks that are not the Moors, living in the midst of many Moors. On May 13th, the mayor called them to come for safety, saying that the Moors were going to attack them. They all went to the city hall, and while they were there, all their possessions were stolen and their homes burned. The doors, windows, roofs were stolen or destroyed on any cement house. So that's people who have a little money. They would put it into, you know, a wood door and stuff. And that's very expensive. Even their mosque was destroyed. A man named Ja Musa, who is works in the merchant marine in the north of the country, was home on vacation in Bohadid. And he says that although it was their Moor neighbors who pillaged their homes, it was certainly with the authorization and collaboration of government officials. He named in particular the military commander, which is it's a military government, so he's the head of the gendarmes and the governor of the region, who are all present. The Halpulars of Bohadid returned to their home, where essentially nothing was left, and somehow lived there for 5 days. For as basic a need as water, they had to ask the military, and it is only, as they say, thanks to God that they ate it all. A few of their black Moor neighbors helped. Refugees named household goods, sheep, chickens, jewelry, anything that can sustain a person as having been stolen. On May 18th, all 59 households were loaded onto a truck. So this was probably like 300 people on one truck. We were like sheep, he said, pushed in one on top of another, said Ja Musa. Because you can imagine this is back of like a, not even a semi, probably a 10-ton truck, which is not really enormous. They were brought to the river, where any remaining possessions, rings, watches, clothes, earrings, which were often ripped forcibly out of the ears of women. If you've seen some of my slides, you know what their earrings are like. That's value. So that was taken. Those, of course, are the stories we hear. I don't know. Were taken before they were put in boats and sent to Senegal. A typical story, and it was very surprising, and I learned a lot of lessons about how little the international community does respond when something like that is going on, and it seems to be well documented. Amnesty International has written reports, Africa Watch has written reports, but in the end, there's very little we can do, and I guess we know that. I don't know if I can convey that at all, because I've heard stories before, but it was when I really lived with that situation and sat and talked to these people, and they said, help us, and we thought, gosh, what can we do? A country can do whatever it wants in its own country, including kick its own citizens out, because, you know, it's against international law, but there isn't an international law that's at all that really has any power to be enforced. Just before the slides, I want to talk just a little bit about ethnic groups, because that's what I've been thinking about a lot. I don't want this to sound far away and like savages in Africa are killing each other again. As I said, the white Moors and the black Moors are our ethnic group. Oh, and just a reminder, in Africa today, we don't usually talk about tribes. That's the old word, and it suggests people living with a different lifestyle, I think, than they actually do. These are settled people, as our ancestors were in Europe. But, you know, what differentiated the Norwegians from the Swedes or something like that? Well, they were in a different place. They had a different language. They're a different ethnic group. Normally, each ethnic group would be a nation. If they had a chance to form themselves into a nation, they would be. But they speak different languages. But what about ethnic conflicts around the world? Often ethnic groups are based on language, sometimes religion. I want you to think for a minute, what very recently even have we heard about ethnic conflicts in the world, not between governments, but simply between ethnic groups? A lot seem to be coming up lately.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Hungarians in Romania is going to be.
Mm-hmm. And that's not so far from us. You know, I mean, these are people certainly that look like us. Why can't the Hungarians get along in Romania? What is that tension? I don't know enough about it, but I assume that they don't look different, that there's not a racial difference, but it's a language difference, right? And those ethnic tensions, we're so committed to our own ethnic group that there are expulsions going on in Europe right now. Others that people think of?
The Armenians and those other people they're fighting. Mm-hmm.
Certainly.
And then there's two other groups that are fighting.
Yes, terrible ethnic tensions in the Soviet Union. Did you mean in the Soviet Union? Yeah. Especially right now. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that gets into the political realm. I certainly don't know enough about the Soviet Union to say anything. But the way it's reported anyway is ethnic tensions.
Protestants and Catholics.
Yeah, that could be thought of as ethnic. Yeah. I think so.
I assume they look alike.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sounds like it's based on religion, but I think it's simply the group that people belong to. How about in the U.S.?
Well, in New York City right now, there are so many different ethnic tensions going on. There's a black-led or African-American-led boycott of Korean stores. There are all the stuff going on in the ghettos.
Yeah. That's the one I was thinking of, because if you're reading the New York Times lately, that seems to be the one that's really, you know, again, ethnic tensions. Well, I don't have any words of wisdom to say about that, but it's just that this is a worldwide problem. We're still committed to our own ethnic groups more than humanity as a whole. Okay, now I'm going to show some slides of the same story, because I think it's hard with something so far away to picture it all. Without the slide, if you want to pull the curtain behind you, if you wouldn't mind. Not too many slides. This is just third slides, but it'll give you a better idea. The Senegal River, as I said, has always been a link between people. People are crossing it every day. When I woke up in the morning, I'd say 200 people crossed the river to get from the village that was on that side of the river to the village that was on that side. But it's a tragedy that suddenly this river, which had always been the link, became a division, became the source of immense suffering for, right now, about 60,000 people are refugees, black Mauritanians that are in Senegal. When they first crossed over, as I said, nobody had a clue where they should go. They went to the nearest villages who received them graciously, but they were living under trees, which was not a real permanent solution. And it was decided by the Senegalese government, who of course has authority there, that they should be moved away from the river itself, because they kept crossing back and attacking for security reasons. Down to the Blacktop Road, which is where they went then. So here's the site that was picked out for them, this beautiful desert site. And, now about 2,500 people live here. And, at that point there was a tent, some government gave tents, everybody gave something, it was really funny, but nobody knew how to construct anything that would be adequate. We hadn't had a lot of rain the year before, so there wasn't much grass. At this season, it was certainly 120 degrees every day. So the main problem was shelter from the shade. There was no possibility of it raining, so at least we didn't have that. But, in 2 months, we knew it would rain. So the problem was to get something that people could sit up out of to get out of the shade. I mean, if you know people from Africa, if you know whites that have been in Africa, they're never tan, because we don't go out in the sun. It's too hot. We sit in the shade. It's really the great search. This is more what the village looks like now. You see different styles of tents, but people have taken upon themselves to build their own shelters, which is really the solution. But it took going through that rainy season to, when more grass grew, that they were able to cut down grass. And this is the kind of shelter building that they did. Of course, it falls on the women to build the houses, as so many other tasks do. And as you see, they were only able to do this when the rainy season finally started and grass grew, so that they had something to cover the houses with. Those first few months were very, very tough. But they dig you see that she's digging little holes to plant, to put these sticks into. And then they tie them together with bark that's been soaked in water. Of course, working together as Africans do to make any task lighter, as difficult and tiring as it is. They went out themselves for the most part and got grass. At the beginning, when she's doing it, she's probably gone 7-8 miles to get that grass to start, because it hasn't grown long yet. This grass where we are will grow longer, and they'll be able to use a lot of that later on. And that's why, of course, they're resting. It's a long walk. A fortunate few were able to use donkeys, and we did use a lot of international money. I mean, money went, I guess I didn't explain this, when the refugees came, our local government officials set up a committee, a crisis committee, to deal with it, and I was on that. And so groups that would give money, like Catholic Relief Service, had a lot of money right away, gave through that committee. And with some of it, we used to hire donkeys and carts from local people so that they could have some extra income with this in turn for the use of their donkeys, so that refugees could carry some of it not on their heads. You see the two houses being almost, well, they need to be closed over the top, and then they need to be covered with grass. And in the end, they come out like this. Now, this is a great house for a refugee. It's traditional. It's what not all of them. I mean, there was a great variety of people. Some of them were living in mud houses. Some of them had government jobs and were probably living in nice cement ones with running water. But for a number of them, this is what they were living in. And with the addition of the plastic tarp from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, do you see that? UNHCR. It comes into a rain-tight house. And it's really a very good situation. So I'm just thrilled with how well things look now. There aren't enough of those plastic sheets for everyone, but there is a number. I mean, so people can go somewhere where it rains. You might also notice that they're really close together. There's no reason for that land-wise. That land was doing nothing and is of no, really, almost no value to anyone. That's why, of course, it was given to the refugees. They could build out as far as they want. But what usually happened is they finally got together and were able to build something. 10 or 15 people together would build one house. And so one was here, and one was way over there, and one was way over there. Now, the more they've stayed there, they've been over a year now, they build one house for each 3 people, perhaps, which is more how they like to live. So that's how they got so crowded in there. Now they don't want to move further away because of the water supply. Also because they're sharing kettles. The number of kettles kettles cost a lot of money. And were very hard to come up with enough. So during most of the year, about 100 people were sharing one kettle. Those 100 people had to arrange themselves to cook together. Now more have been given, and I think that almost every family has a kettle now, which is a great improvement.
What is the tall pole for?
Is there a tall pole?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the antenna. You see, my town was more modern than we think. For the telephones. The telephones, which rarely worked, but at least it wasn't the wires that would come down. I mean, it used to be that winds would come and the wires would be knocked down. Well, then the whole country, the whole northern link would be out. And now they have a microwave system, I think, as much as I understand. So, like, we could telephone from the post office and it would be sent up the antenna and on to the next antenna, so we could go to Dakar. International organizations worked very hard. On the whole, I think that they do what we're hoping that they do. The reason I got so involved was because that they weren't there when it started, and it's very difficult for them to start up. The refugees first started coming in, and really nobody was working with them except Oxfam was very fast. You can always give to Oxfam if you're looking for an organization. They're very, very good. And what else? Catholic Relief Service was pretty fast. But the ELCA, as I've written about and talked about some, was about as fast as any. We called the office in Chicago and told them about this problem, and they said that it would be possible to give up to $15,000 fairly quickly. It's in the hunger appeal money, hunger fund, what's it called? The hunger program, I forget. But it's not designated. It's saved aside for emergencies. Because, of course, we know that we want to budget most of our money at the beginning of the year so it can go to the best possible uses, whether education or relief or development work. But some of the money, which, I mean, I hope that many of you have given to that, so I hope that it's your money, was left available for emergencies that could come up, and they were able to make that money available very, very quickly. And the first, one of the first shipments that went to the area came from that money, along with some other organizations that we worked together with. 2 months later, we knew that the High Commissioner for Refugees was going to come in, but it was fully 2 months before they got operational at all. They had to rent houses first. They had to put air conditioning in their offices. They had to get people to send there. I mean, and to do an international search, it's not very fast before they can get people there. The International Red Cross, I should say, was the main organization coordinating everything before they came in. They took the responsibility right away, the International Red Cross, and there were Swiss people there, but it was not at all adequate to the needs. So I feel that it was a great privilege for me to be just happen to live in a place where suddenly there was this enormous emergency need. I had my house. I didn't have my air conditioning, but I had my shower. I mean, I had a place to live at least, and so was there. And especially had worked in my village for 4 years, long enough fairly well, and be able to work together in this committee that our local government officials set up. And that was really a great privilege because, as I said, these Senegalese people were so dedicated to receiving their Mauritanian brothers and sisters. So this is, as a matter of fact, I think this is the first truck that came up. We're going to start with 10 tons, and then they said, oh, let's just send 25 tons. That was the Senegalese pastor of the Protestant church who we worked with especially. And he had I'm sure he was not a Protestant, but some friends of his donated the truck, and I don't know how else we got it. But this truck came up and unloading. There was sorghum, there was rice. Those sacks are all about 50 kilos, 110 pounds, I don't know if I should translate that for you. And this sack is 100 kilos, 220 pounds. And we unloaded so many of those, but don't think that I can even get, I can lift up maybe a quarter of it. They're really heavy, heavy, heavy sacks. These guys, I learned all about unloading and stuff. These guys get about $1.50, a little less per ton that they unload and carry into the storage area. After that, the refugees themselves did it, but at the very beginning, there was no organization. So the food is all right now, I can refer to you. I mean, there have been many, many shortages. It's come mainly from the U.S. government and the European governments through the World Food Program. Both of those were through the World Food Program. So as I said to Dick Cain here once, there are useful things. I mean, once in a while, our food aid does go to a very necessary place. There was not that quantity of food in the region to buy. I mean, that would have been the alternative if people had been willing to give money. The millet and sorghum were all bought locally, but the rice and certainly the oil especially, which is always short in that country, they import tremendous amounts, had to come from overseas anyway, and so through the World Food Program it really worked out very well. This slide I have to talk about water. This is months later. The High Commissioner for Refugees finally got a few wells dug. In my town in June, we had running water by that time, so people were able to drink piped water. I mean, they had to walk a distance, but not too far, and that was plenty of very good water. Although the issue, of course, was who would pay their share of the pumping costs, which everyone in town paid. We all pay, as you do too, your water bill. Who's going to pay the refugees' water bill? Because with 2,000 of them, they're drinking quite a lot of water. So they threatened to cut it off a number of times until finally the High Commissioner of Refugees managed to do that. In this village, they dug a well. Not a good well, it doesn't have enough water, but anyway, you see that women are pulling it up. They dug the well, but people didn't have enough buckets. That's an empty U.S. oil can, and you'll see a number of them used for different things. People used the sacks, people used the oil cans because they came with nothing. This was one of my projects, so I just have to show you. When they were first going to move in, I mean, that was my thought, what about sanitation? And this International Red Cross guy said, oh gosh, you know, who can do any, can you do latrines? I said, I don't know, I've never done one. But they said, why don't you try and we'll reimburse you. Oh, okay, so then that was my little project to figure out how to do a latrine and then, you know, buy the cement, buy the reinforcing rod, get the gravel there, get the sand there, and hire a mason, and it worked out with many problems. I mean, the refugees, the first refugees that came had been teachers and different kinds of government officials in Senegal and didn't feel that it was their task to dig. I mean, these were, they apologized months later. They said, you have to realize we were in such shock. Our life situation had gone from very powerful people in town. We were respected. We were the teachers. We were the nurses. We were people like that. To suddenly, we're having to dig our own latrines. I mean, we couldn't handle it at all. We've lost all our possessions. Maybe our families haven't come, and they didn't do it. So, but now people were working wonderfully together by the time I left. And of course, I'll just throw in that the women is really what held things together. The men at first, I mean, they had more likely lost their professions. The main profession of men in the area was herding. And for the herders, it didn't kill them to have been kicked off their land. What did was that their animals were all confiscated. And so they were left with no animals. And that's their capital. And that's what hurt them. So the men were lost, didn't know what to do. So what are they doing now to start building their lives back up? Nobody knows when they'll be able to go back. Of course, we were hoping that it would be a few weeks and then a few months, and then it seemed it was going to be at least a year. There's no sign whatsoever that they'll be able to go back, although Senegal and Mauritania are finally coming to a peace, a sort of peace, but it may be with the refugees staying in Senegal. I mean, Senegal's condition for peace was always that all the refugees have to be able to go back, but they don't seem to have any bargaining power. And so things don't look good. So they have to figure out new lives for themselves. These are still kind of emergency camps. You can't have 2,000 herders living together and expect it to be a viable community. It can't possibly work. But gradually people are starting to get something. You'll see these little projects they're starting with, and then they'll move out into the grasslands. There's vast prairie it's probably overgrazed and does not need the influx of tens of thousands more refugees, but they might be able to sort of make it. So this is the garden that the women started. The women in this village, I worked in several refugee villages, and these were not the greatest gardeners. So if it doesn't look good, they had never gardened before. They were all herders. But these are potatoes, and they had a number of other things growing. You notice that they're using these, well, this is sorghum, as a matter of fact. This is U.S. sorghum that also started coming in because local supplies were simply not enough. And they grew tomatoes and lettuce. And these refugees, this is a different town now, were able to sell quite a bit of it and earn money. The women's group has their own money now. Barb's caption is that they were planting trees. I have to say that the best of these slides are my sister Barbara's slides. The ones that are too dark for the most part are mine. but anyway, it gives you another example of all the things they use the U.S. Sorghum sacks for. This guy on the left, whose name is Abdoulaye Ba, I think, he's a trained agriculturalist. So he's the person that worked with the refugees for the most part. We found money for him for transport, that he could take local public transportation and go to the different sites and work with the refugees on their gardens. Can anyone guess what this is? I don't think even I would, but make a guess. An enclosure. Huh?
It's a mosque.
It's a mosque. That's right. Very good. Chapel would certainly be the equivalent. Notice how well it's swept clean. Dirt can be clean or dirt can be dirty, and this is clean dirt. And the men in any village would regularly gather to pray. I think as I was amazed at how religious they were, much more religious than the Senegalese, who are the same ethnic group that I worked with for so long, I think it's a fact of suffering. And losing everything that you owned makes you more appreciative of the one thing that can't be taken away from your faith. And you think a lot more about God. And the refugees prayed very regularly. This is the religious leader in this particular village called Dodel. Anyone guess what this is?
School?
Yes. Boy, you guys are great. This is a school. It's not done yet. But this picture was Barb's picture in the Last World Encounter magazine, if you happen to read that. The refugees themselves built this much of a structure and then were given the mats to put on top, well, grass on top and mats around the outside. And I found money, it was with Catholic Relief Services, as a matter of fact, to make blackboards. And the German government gave mats to put on the ground, and that's how children, they had, we bought slates and chalk for the teachers. That was the main thing, and a teaching manual. One book for each teacher, and that was the materials with which they were able to start. It cost a lot of money, but it seems pretty minimal material, as long as the teachers who were trained, qualified teachers, were willing to teach for free. This guy, Abdu'l-Bahá, who's the president, the guy with the tennis shoes there, if you see in all the books, he's the president of one of the camps, and he's kind of one of the young, hot-headed people. There's a great variety within the refugees. I mean, many are saying, well, God sent us here, or, I mean, you know, there's nothing else we can do. We'll just pray, and we'll just wait for somebody to do something. There were many people who said that. There were many people who said, we're going back to Mauritania. We don't care if it's in peace. We don't care if it's in war. We don't care how many people we have to kill or be killed. We're going back to Mauritania. It's our land. And he was definitely one of those. And he would also lead raids into Mauritania. I mean, people were continually crossing the river and stealing whatever cattle or whatever they found on the Mauritanian side, considering that it was theirs. But he was a wonderful guy. He really got the camp with 2,000 people in it very well disciplined. This is the Dodel camp. And the woman standing next to him is the president of the women in that village, Fatima Tissot. This slide I know is too dark, but it just shows the refugee teachers who are really some of the people that I admire most of all the people I've met in Africa. I really had immense admiration for them. And that's a party that we had at my house, one of the few times in my 5 years there that we really had dancing and singing and lots of meat to eat and everything. It was a nice, well, chance for me to sort of thank them for all the work they did for their children and are still doing. And especially to have a good time because I thought they were such interesting people. Other refugees are gradually getting into, they're trying to earn a little money here and there. Many are selling things in the market, and you don't need a huge capital to start up if you can get somebody to loan you the stuff, you know, a sack underneath you and a sack over you to prevent, to stop the sun, and you have a place in the market. And if you can find something to sell, you sell it. Other refugees are hiring themselves out as herders. Women are working in local people's houses, and of course these local people aren't very rich, so they may pay them $10 at the end of a month, maybe. And that's not a lot of money in Senegal. It's a very expensive country. But gradually they're trying to build up their own capital. If they have money, for the most part, what they'll buy with it is animals. And that's what they're hoping. Whether they go back to Mauritania or whether they stay here, they need animals. Also, they'll buy tea, which is their favorite refreshment of any kind. It's really an entertainment. It's a tea ceremony. And of course, international aid never brings tea. At the very beginning, they got some tea. And then one of the French Minister for International Development came to visit, as many other people did. I mean, we had the German ambassador, the Belgian ambassador, the American ambassador, and I don't know who else, coming to our town. People from the Organization for African Unity came too. And anyway, they brought up to this French minister especially that they were having trouble because they had no tea. And so now, just before I left also, they got a whole huge shipment of tea, which was very nice, because you can live on the basics, but you can't really live. And they've had so much upheaval and so much struggle that it's nice if they have what they really consider the center of their day's activities almost, is when they drink tea. Again, why the struggle happened. And this, I hope, is another thing that you can relate to other areas of the world. The number of refugees that I'm talking about is very small in world terms, 60,000. But of course, those are 60,000 lives. Those are 60,000 people that came to my very small area. But when I read about Sudan with I don't know how many millions of refugees right now, it seems insignificant. But issues are often the same. The issue here was land. And land, the richness of the land, it's very good soil, and it can be irrigated since it's along the river. Most of the soil that you see is desert sand, and that's as soon as you get out of the river valley, it changes completely. But the clay, the heavy clays right next to the river are extremely good land, and they're the main hope for the future for a country like Mauritania. And these lands have always been in the hands of the blacks, and here is a rice harvest. They're harvesting, if you can see, they're sort of thrashing, the harvesting and they're thrashing. But it produces an enormous amount of food. It certainly is the breadbasket of Mauritania. The other crop is this, which is flood recession sorghum. This is the traditional crop, which when the river floods, allows an enormous production also. Although you see the plants are widely spaced, but there's so many hundreds of thousands of acres that are flooded that it's a very large crop. The Mauritanians, the Moors, I mean, I should say that, it's not, because the refugees are Mauritanian citizens, but the ethnic group that kicked them out is the Moors. The whites, for the most part, who have power in the country. They're traditionally camel people, and it's a different lifestyle. They traditionally lived up in what we consider to be desert, but that land is no longer productive enough, and they see the agricultural potential of the Senegal River. It's been exacerbated by the fact that two very large dams have been built on the Senegal River, and this might remind you of some other countries. Dams cause a lot of problems. Whether they cause more problems than they solve, I mean, is another issue, but they cause many, many, many problems. And traditionally, all the issues have not been addressed adequately before dams are built. Huge areas are flooded, and people have to shift from a traditional sort of irrigation with flood recession farming to irrigated agriculture. There was a big fight before these dams went in, but that was before my time. Now the dams are built, they're done. They're not paid for by the U.S. for a change. That was a happy thing to learn. They were paid for by European governments and the Arabs. A lot of Saudi money and Kuwaiti money went into these dams, which what they will do is regularize the flow of the Senegal River so that irrigation is possible year-round. Potentially, they could have three crops a year of rice, but potentially also they could have huge health problems. People lose their land. The land tenure issues change totally, and this is what happened. As the potential goes way up, the Arabs in power, the whites in power, saw the value of the land and a profession that they had traditionally had no interest in. They think that farming is a rather undignified profession, but now they wanted that land. And we think that's probably the main reason why they kicked all these refugees out. So this, as I said at the beginning, this river, which has always linked a group of people, which has been right in the center of their land, became a very divisive thing. And as I leave, there are tanks pointed with their guns across the river on both sides. We could go up to the Senegal River and look across to Mauritanians just on the other side and see soldiers parading with guns. Refugees on this side can look at their old villages and say, you know, that's my house, that's my house. Moors have, for the most part, moved into their villages, which they were forced out of, and are living there. And it's a place that's not going to see peace very soon. Even if the governments come to peace, which is what will happen, the people are angry at each other, and they'll keep fighting. So it's one of many very tragic areas in the world. Very small, but again, it shows the kind of problems that people are facing, and as I put this slide, the problems that people are struggling to deal with. And the women, of course, have probably suffered the most, but are just making fantastic efforts to build a new life in the new land that they have for what they hope is a short time, but it may turn out to be a long time. Okay, as I said at the beginning, it's a story that I find fascinating, but I think I'm afraid that it seems very far to some of us. I noted a few other issues that it raises, which also are come up in other areas of the world. One, as I said, the world seems to be doing very little. All the countries, including whether it's the Arab countries, the Western countries, whatever, know what's happening, but it's not in their interest to challenge Mauritania. why doesn't the American government challenge it? They say that Mauritania is one of the most reasonable Arab governments. It's one of our few friends, and they're not going to cause any problems with that. We don't have a lot of friends in the Arab world. The French should be doing something. They're the biggest power. They've got forces in both Senegal and Mauritania, and most people say if they forced them to take them back, they probably could, but the world doesn't work that way anymore. Well, the Arabs could be doing more, and the main Islamic organization, the Islamic Conference Organization, because of course all the people are Muslim, blacks and Moors, they're all Muslim. And that may be one of the reasons that the countries will finally come to peace. The large Islamic Conference Organization is meeting in Senegal, this democracy that I've told you about, in 1991, a fact that alarms the Christians there, and we'll see what that means. But most countries just say that the issue is too small, it's too unimportant to really create an international problem. It doesn't affect enough people. The other thing that's interesting is, what should the refugees do now? It echoes other organizations like, you know, SWAPO or ANC or something, people that fight for liberation in their country. How can they get support? What should they do? Should they work with nonviolent means? What would those nonviolent means be? What is it possible for these refugees who are very angry, who have had their land, their animals, and all their belongings taken away from them? What should they do? And that's why I try and talk in a personal way. For me, facing these people face to face and trying to think what to say to them, what even could a possible answer be? I didn't have an answer, so I just listened. But at least I'm really happy to be able to talk to more people here. I think it's an issue that the world should know about. They're organizing themselves. They already have a sort of liberation movement, which they had before this problem happened. They felt like the blacks were discriminated against in Mauritania for a long, long time. But now they're, of course, able to organize much better because there are so many thousands of refugees. And many of them are very humane people, do not want to cause violence, but don't know another way to respond to this situation. So I think it's a situation that's going to continue to be violent for many, many years to come. I don't know what kind of questions you might have or comments. Does that make you think of other situations in the world, or... what kind of comments do people have?
Are there many Christians in these communities too?
No. In the area that I was, there are essentially no Christians. There were Christians, but they came from the south. There are Senegalese Christians in the south, especially in the south of the country. So if they are professional people, they can be sent by the government up to the north. So we had a Christian community, very small as it was, but there would be at some points the doctor, and the hospital director was a Christian, various teachers, a few nurses would be Christians, but of the local people there were no Christians, 100% Muslim, and that was certainly a force that drew them together.
What kind of direction is your particular ministry heading?
Well, I'm back now.
No, but when you're there.
We won't be working with the refugees anymore. And it never was our intention to do a lot because we know so little about how to work with refugees. I mean, I always thought there are experts in this. I shouldn't be doing anything. But the fact was that I was there. But now that the High Commissioner for Refugees is there, they handle everything. I mean, I just did a few other projects like the gardens, like the school, because I knew and really liked the people and wanted them to be able to have that. But it's totally in the hands of the United Nations. Although I can just say that I hear that they're really having a hard time getting enough of anything right now because the attention of the United Nations, because of course the Office for West Africa is in Dakar, is being drawn entirely to Liberia right now. This was even happening as I was there. And if you're reading a little bit about what's happening in Liberia, it's even more tragic. Just like that, there's more refugees. I think there's hundreds of thousands now in Liberia and the neighboring countries already, Ivory Coast, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Another very tragic situation that just pops up. So suddenly, Mauritania and Senegal have to be pushed into the background. Hopefully they can get some food, but it'll be cut back as the years go on. But we don't have any role. Dan?
It reminds me of an analysis I read of war in our age is very seldom between nations, like in the old days. But most of the wars on Earth are in
one nation that's been kind of artificially carved out, where one ethnic group has more power than another. And this, in the past, has been used to become an east-west conflict. It's often between one ethnic group that is running the country over another ethnic group that would like to be liberated. Does that kind of fit in?
It absolutely fits in. And I'm sure that I had known that and heard that before, but this situation made me see how...
All over the world, that's where so much of the war is. And we've often confused that because we've looked at it on as east-west, you know, which side is more on the side of the Soviet Union, communism, which side is more on the side of capitalism in the West.
I don't know what this says about our response. Mm-hmm. Should there be any response? Or is it our position to just sit and watch? Maybe that's the best. But at least not get involved with that idea, as you say.
Did you have any kind of worship services, or how do you promote Christianity in what you're doing with these people?
We had a worship service. Like I say, this group of Christians, there were usually Finnish missionaries where I was. They would come and go as we would. Mm-hmm. And now as I left, there's another American family that's in a sense replacing me, but he's working with animals. So they've been there for about the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. And ranging from 2 to as high as 10 Senegalese, who are all Roman Catholic, but fortunately in that situation we don't have to worry about them. I mean, some people do. Some of the Protestants are horrified. But anyway, we worship together in one of our houses. But it doesn't sound like a Holden Vespers at all, so it's really fun for me to come and hear really good music after our pathetic little music of 10 people trying to...
It looked to me like on your slide of your party that all the guests were men.
Well, that was the problem. I mean, except that's why I had
the
other missionaries. I invited them. I told them, I asked the women specifically to come. But the problem is, if the wives of the teachers are there, there were no women teachers. They didn't happen to have that education. In Mauritania, I think it's been even more than Senegal. Women have a very difficult time getting an education like that. But I asked the wives to come along, but the problem is if they're married, they have children, and they don't have someone to take care of the children. So the women stayed home with the children, and the men came. We did bring a lot of food up to the women, though, at least. But, that's a big problem. In Senegal, more and more women are becoming teachers. In the local school, for example, we had 2 women teachers out of 12. So that's good. That's much better.